All right. So, everyone always talks about how important the Fourth Amendment is.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But a lot of times I think it can be really hard to like see how it plays out in actual cases,
Totally. It's like all these abstract principles
Yeah,
until,
exactly. Until you get a real life example.
yeah, you're like, oh, okay, wait, this
And
is,
then you see how the sausage is made.
yeah, exactly. And you're like, whoa, this has some real consequences.
Exactly. So that's what we're going to try to do today.
I'm excited.
Yeah. So today's deep dive is all about search warrants.
Ooh, one of my favorite.
That's, I know, right? Search and seizure, it's like classic con law stuff.
It's the bread and butter.
But it's really important because it gets at the core of like what the Fourth Amendment is all about. It's
Totally.
protecting us from unreasonable searches and seizures.
Exactly.
So for this deep dive, we're going to be looking at a case that came out of the First Circuit,
Okay.
United States versus Tengwe. It was decided back in 2015. And we also have this really awesome case brief that breaks down all the kind of nitty-gritty legal stuff.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, so we'll be like bouncing back and forth between the actual opinion and this case brief
Nice.
just to make sure we're covering all our bases.
Awesome. Sounds like a good plan.
Yeah. So to set the stage right, the Fourth Amendment says that the police can't just barge into your house or
Right.
like search your stuff without a good
All
reason.
right.
They usually need a warrant, and to get a warrant, they have to go to a judge and show them that they have probable cause.
That's right.
But what happens when the information that the police use to get that warrant, like the evidence that they present to the judge, comes from someone who's not exactly, known for their honesty?
Interesting.
That's the kind of the sticky wicket that this Tengwe case gets into.
Okay, I'm hooked already.
So let's jump into it.
Let's do it.
So to start, like what's the big legal question here in this case? What are we really trying to figure out?
Yeah, so I think at its core, the Tangway case is about this tension between effective law enforcement, right?
Right.
We want the police to be able to solve crimes
Of
and to
course.
keep our communities safe, but we also want to make absolutely sure that they're not cutting corners or
Right.
violating people's constitutional rights in the process.
Exactly. It's all about balance.
Exactly. And in this particular case, it all hinges on an informant.
Okay. The plot thickens.
Yeah.
So who is this informant and why are they so important to the case?
All right. So the informant in this case is a guy named Wiggin.
Okay.
And Wiggin is, well, he's an interesting character to say the least,
I bet.
because he's got a bit of a history.
A bit of a
Yeah, a
past.
bit of a checkered past, you could say.
Okay, lay it on me. What'd this guy do?
So this is where it gets wild.
Okay.
When Wiggin was a juvenile, he was actually convicted for faking a sniper attack.
Wait, he like made up a whole sniper attack?
He did more than just make it up. He actually shot himself.
He shot himself.
Yeah, to make it look like there was a real sniper on the loose.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's a little more than just scrapes.
Right. So that right there tells you a lot about his credibility.
Yeah, I mean, talk about a red flag.
Huge red flag.
Okay, so we got this informant, Wiggin, who's already got some serious baggage when it comes to telling the truth.
Exactly.
How does he end up getting involved in the Tangway case?
Okay, so Wiggin goes to this police officer named Officer Nolet,
Okay.
and he tells Nolet that he knows this guy, Jonathan Tangway,
Right.
and that Tangway has child pornography on his laptop.
Ooh, okay, so now we're into some serious allegations.
Very serious stuff.
So what happens next? Does Nolet just take Wiggin's word for it and go get a warrant?
Well, that's where things get really interesting, because here's the thing. Another officer, Sergeant Breuer,
Okay.
he actually warns Nolet about Wiggin.
Like, hey, this guy's not exactly reliable.
Basically, yeah, Breuer tells Nolet that Wiggin has had some, quote, scrapes in the past.
Scrapes.
Yeah, which we know is a pretty significant understatement.
Right. A little bit of an understatement considering the whole fake sniper incident.
Just a tad.
So, but even with this warning, Nola decides to go ahead and apply for a search warrant.
He does, and this is a crucial part of the case, he does it without doing any further investigation into Wiggin's background.
So he doesn't even bother to like run a basic background check or anything.
Nope, he just takes Wiggin's word for it and goes to the judge.
Okay, so that seems like a pretty big misstep, right?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that it was a pretty significant oversight.
So walk me through what happens with the warrant application. Like, what does Nolet actually tell the judge?
So Nolet puts together this affidavit, which is basically a sworn statement laying out the evidence that he's using to justify the search.
Right.
And in this affidavit, he includes the information that Wiggin gave him about Tangway having child pornography on his laptop.
Okay, makes sense.
But, and here's the kicker, the affidavit completely leaves out any mention of Wiggins' history of dishonesty.
He doesn't mention the fake sniper attack.
Nope, not a word about it.
Nope. Wow, okay, that seems like a pretty big omission.
It's a major omission, and it's going to come back to bite Nola later on.
I bet. So before we get to that, though, let's take a step back and talk about the law that's at play here.
Sounds good.
So there's this landmark Supreme Court case called Franks versus Delaware.
Right.
Which is all about the truthfulness of the information that's used in warrant applications.
Super important case.
Hugely important. So what does Franks say? Like, what's the gist of it?
So basically, Franks sets this really important precedent that says that the affidavit that the police use to get a search warrant has to be truthful.
Okay, so that makes sense. It can't be based on lies.
Exactly. But it goes even deeper than that, because it also says that the affidavit can't contain any intentional or reckless material falsehoods.
Okay, so it's not just outright lying. It's also about being reckless with the truth.
Exactly. And that can include either putting in false information or leaving out crucial information that would change the whole picture.
Got it. So it's about presenting a complete and accurate picture to the judge.
Precisely.
Okay, so with that in mind, let's go back to the Tangway case. So what happened after Nolet submitted his affidavit to the judge? Did they grant the warrant?
Yeah, the judge looked at the affidavit, and based on the information that was presented,
right,
they decided that there was enough probable cause to issue the warrant.
Okay.
So the police searched Tangway's place, and they actually ended up finding child pornography.
Wow. Okay. So they actually found evidence of a crime.
They did.
So at this point, it seems like case closed, right?
Well, not so fast, because remember, the whole issue here is how that warrant was obtained.
Right. Right. With the whole informant situation.
Exactly.
So what happened next? Did Tangway just plead guilty?
No. Tangley's lawyers decided to challenge the warrant.
Based on what?
They argued that the warrant was invalid because Nolet had either intentionally or recklessly left out crucial information about Wiggins' credibility.
So they're saying that Nolet violated the Franks rule.
Precisely. And that because of that violation, any evidence that was obtained as a result of the warrant should be thrown out. Okay, so this is where things get really interesting from a legal perspective.
Absolutely.
Because now we have to figure out whether Nolet's actions were actually a violation of Franks.
Right.
So what did the lower court say? How did they rule on this issue?
So the district court initially sided with the government.
Okay.
They looked at the facts of the case, and they basically said that the police don't have a specific duty to investigate the credibility of every informant they use.
Okay, so they're saying that Nolet didn't necessarily do anything wrong by not looking into Wiggins' background.
That's right. Their reasoning was that as long as the officer believes the information to be true at the time that they presented to the judge,
yeah,
then they're not violating Franks, even if it turns out later that the informant was lying or had a shady past.
Okay, I can see how they got there, but it also seems like it could create some problems.
Yeah, it definitely opens the door for potential abuse.
Exactly. Like, what's to stop a police officer from just using any old shady character as an informant and then just turning a blind eye to their past?
Right. It's a slippery slope.
Okay, so I'm guessing the story doesn't end there.
You guessed it. This is where the First Circuit comes in.
Okay, so the case goes up on appeal.
Yep. Tangway appeals the district court's ruling.
And what does the First Circuit have to say about all this?
So the First Circuit takes a very different view of the situation.
Okay.
They basically say that the district court got it completely wrong.
Whoa, strong words.
Yeah, they were not messing around.
All right, so how did the First Circuit see things differently? What was their reasoning?
So the First Circuit says that the whole point of Franks is to make sure that judges who are issuing warrants have all the information they need.
Right, to make an informed decision.
Exactly. They need to have the full picture, both the good and the bad.
Right.
So they can decide whether there's really probable cause.
Makes sense.
And the First Circuit says that if police officers are allowed to just ignore obvious signs that an informant might be unreliable,
yeah,
then it completely undermines the whole purpose of Franks.
Okay, so they're basically saying that Nolet had a duty to investigate Wiggin further, especially given the warning he got from Sergeant Breuer.
Exactly.
They couldn't just sweep that under the rug.
Nope. The First Circuit says that there were obvious reasons to doubt Wiggin's credibility.
And that those obvious reasons triggered a duty to investigate.
Precisely.
Okay, so what kind of standard are we talking about here? Like, how obvious do these reasons have to be?
Right. So the First Circuit gives us some really helpful guidance on this.
Okay. Good.
They basically say that it doesn't require overwhelming proof that the informant is lying.
Okay.
It's more about whether there are clear red flags that should make a reasonable officer think twice.
Hmm. Okay, so it's not about being absolutely certain, it's about reasonable suspicion.
Exactly. And in this case, they specifically point to Wiggins' past conviction for faking a sniper attack.
Right, that whole thing.
As a prime example of an obvious reason to doubt his credibility.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty hard to ignore.
Right. It's not just some minor offense. It shows a real pattern of dishonesty.
And a willingness to go to pretty extreme lengths to deceive people.
Totally. And the Fourth Circuit actually uses this really great quote.
Okay, let's hear it.
They say, quote, "All that is required is an obvious and unexplored reason to doubt."
Hmm. I like that. An obvious and unexplored reason to doubt.
Right. It really captures the essence of the standard.
It's not about having all the answers. It's about recognizing when there are serious questions that need to be answered.
Exactly.
Okay, so the First Circuit says that Nolet screwed up by not investigating Wiggin further.
Right.
But they don't stop there, do they?
Nope. They actually go a step further and lay out this four-part test.
A four-part test? All right, this is getting juicy.
This test is super helpful for figuring out whether the duty to investigate has been triggered.
Okay, I'm all ears. What's the first part?
So first, they ask, were there obvious reasons to doubt the informant's truthfulness?
Okay, that's kind of what we've been talking about.
Right, and in this case, with Wiggins' history, that one's pretty clear-cut.
Yeah.
The second part is, was the failure to investigate further reckless?
Okay, so it's not just about whether there were red flags, it's also about the officer's state of mind.
Exactly. It gets at whether they consciously disregarded those red flags.
So it's about more than just negligence, it's about recklessness.
Right, like were they deliberately turning a blind eye to the problem?
Got it.
The third part of the test is, would further inquiry have revealed material facts that should have been included in the affidavit?
So basically, if Nolet had done his due diligence, would he have found stuff that should have been in the warrant application?
Precisely. And again, in this case, it seems pretty likely that a basic background check would have revealed Wiggins' history of dishonesty.
Yeah, that seems like a no-brainer.
And then finally, the fourth part of the test is, with the omitted information included, would the affidavit still have established probable cause?
Ah, so this is the million-dollar question.
It really is, because if the judge had known about Wiggins' past, would they still have issued the warrant?
Right. It gets at whether the whole foundation of the warrant was shaky.
Exactly. And that's something that the district court needs to reevaluate on remand.
Okay, so hold up. Remand? What does that mean? Does that mean that Tanguay automatically wins and the evidence gets thrown out?
Not necessarily. Remand means that the First Circuit is sending the case back down to the district court with instructions to reconsider their ruling.
So they're saying, hey, you need to look at this again with the right legal framework.
Exactly. They're saying, take another look at this whole probable cause issue now that you know about Wiggins' history and now that you understand the correct standard for the duty to investigate.
So the First Circuit isn't saying that the warrant was definitely invalid.
Right.
They're just saying that the lower court needs to take another look at it with all the facts on the table.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's a pretty significant outcome, right? It means that Tanguay's challenge to the warrant wasn't just dismissed outright.
Absolutely. The First Circuit took his argument seriously and recognized that there were some serious problems with the way the warrant was obtained.
So for all our listeners out there who are law students, what are the big takeaways from this case? Like, what should they be thinking about when they're studying search and seizure law?
Well, I think Tanguay is a great example of how those abstract Fourth Amendment principles we talk about in class actually play out in the real world.
Right. It shows that these aren't just academic exercises. They have real consequences.
Exactly. And I think for law students, one of the biggest lessons here is about the importance of due diligence.
Especially when you're dealing with informants.
Especially with informants. You can't just take their word as gospel. You have to do your homework.
Right. Run those background checks.
Exactly. Because if there are red flags, you need to be upfront about them.
Both with the judge who's issuing the warrant.
Right.
And potentially with the defense if the case goes to trial.
Exactly. Transparency is key.
And I think it also shows that the courts are really paying attention to these issues.
Oh, yeah. They're not just rubber stamping warrants.
Nope. They're scrutinizing the process to make sure that people's constitutional rights are being protected.
Right. It's a good reminder that the system is designed to have checks and balances.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground today.
We have.
But before we wrap things up, I want to leave our listeners with something to think about.
Okay, hit me.
So Tanguay was decided back in 2015, And a lot has changed in the world of law enforcement since then.
For sure.
Especially when it comes to the kinds of information that they use to build cases.
Right. We've got all this new technology, social media, digital footprints.
Exactly. So my question for our listeners is this. How do you think the principles that we've talked about today, the duty to investigate, the importance of informant credibility, the whole idea of reckless disregard for the truth, how do you think those principles should be applied to these new sources of information?
That's a really good question.
Like, if the police are relying on a tip from some anonymous internet troll, should they be held to the same standard as if they were relying on a tip from a traditional confidential informant?
It's a tricky issue. Right. Because on the one hand, we want law enforcement to be able to use all the tools at their disposal to investigate crime.
Yeah, they got to keep up with the times.
Exactly. But on the other hand, we don't want to erode the protections of the Fourth Amendment.
And we definitely don't want them going on fishing expeditions based on flimsy evidence.
Absolutely not.
So, yeah, it's a tough question and there's no easy answer, but it's definitely something that's worth thinking about as we move forward in this increasingly digital age.
Definitely. It's like a whole new frontier for Fourth Amendment law.
Well said. Well, on that note, I think it's time to wrap things up.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much for joining me for this deep dive into United States versus Tanguay.
This was great. I always love getting into the weeds of a good case.
Me too. And thanks to all our listeners for tuning in.
Keep those brains engaged.
Absolutely. Until next time, stay curious.
And stay informed.